of this accord. We invite high school students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. And when they accept the invitation, they're sent materials about this case and have done some work on the case, and they're here to listen to us. And as a result of this program, we also have a justice of this court join us for a discussion with the students at noon after this case ends. So today, we have with us Waupun High School. Would those students please stand? And welcome to the Waupun High School students. You may be seated. And we have Mayville High School students. Would you all stand, please? Let's not be shy. Do we have them all? I've got a number count here. Yeah, I knew we could get some more. Thank you. You may be seated. And we also have with us the Honorable Ralph Ramirez of the Waukesha County Circuit Court, Judge Ramirez. And you have guests. We're delighted to see you, Mrs. Ramirez. And Judge Ramirez is going to appear today at a Law Day luncheon to be held here, talking about the Brown versus Board of Education case, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. That is a case which removed segregation from the public schools in this country. And he will be joined by others who will talk at our Color of Justice celebration. Now let me introduce the court to you all. I'll start on my far right, and that's Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to Justice Sykes is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser will meet with you this noon and will be the justice who will discuss the processes of this court. He will not discuss the substance of the case. And not only are the students invited to this session at noon, but anyone in the courtroom who wishes to remain and hear Justice Prosser is cordially invited to do that. He will join us when he can at the Board Day luncheon upstairs. And on the far left is Justice Patience Robinsack. With the introductions made, I'll call the second case for our calendar, 02-2404-CR State versus Joseph. Is it Gerard?
Yes.
And representing Mr. Gerard is Attorney Joseph L. Summers. Mr. Summers, you may proceed.
Okay. Thank you. Well, this case actually is, I think this is somewhat of an interesting case, but I think it's a case, too, that allows, let's say, this court and allows basically the entire system to go back and to take a look at what really matters. Why is everybody here? You know, it's not ironic, of course, that all of you are referred to as justice. It's not ironic that today that I think the Supreme Chief Judge made a reference that after today we're going to have, there's a justice, I think she said, celebration. And the point of all that, of course, is that under our system, the law is supposed to be on the same page with justice. The reason why we have trials is to make sure that they are just. We have trials to make sure that people who actually did crimes are convicted of crimes, not maybe crimes that were committed by other people, like in this case, committed by the defendant's brother, but crimes that were actually, that they are convicted of crimes that they have actually done. Now, with that as well, it's understood, of course, that everybody wants the trial, if at all possible, to be the last step. We don't want to bring in victims again to have to testify for a second time. We don't want the system to put on all the expense that it has to put on. And of course, we don't want trial attorneys to be basically put in a situation where they're afraid to do trials. I am different probably from a lot of appellate attorneys that are here in that I do a lot of trials. In fact, I do a heck of a lot of trials. And I do a lot of trials on serious cases, which means to a certain extent I know the pressure that trial attorneys are under. But I also know the fact that from what I see all the time, the trial attorneys also, though, can operate under the impression that, you know what, even if you goof up, even if basically you do a minimal effort, you don't have to worry about it really all that much. Because you know what? The system will do anything it can, basically, to save you. It will protect you. It will step in, even if, let's say, you should have investigated people, even if, let's say, you should have put people on the witness stand, even if you should have basically lifted a finger, and you didn't. Well, you can basically be guaranteed, a lot of times, the system will come in, the system will see to it that you are protected. And in this case, that's exactly what happened. And I don't know, I don't know if maybe I'm wrong or somehow I'm so blind that I can't see what other people are seeing. But
Mr. Summers, let me interrupt you if I might. Given the concession near the end of the state's brief, have you not already won this case? Isn't the state conceding that there ought to be a new trial in the interest of justice?
Actually, I guess if you read it that way, I'd be just say that right now, that we had a new trial, I'll shut up and leave.
Well, I'm so fast. You deprive the students of your argument, but do you read the state's concession that way?
I don't think they quite made it that way, but again, I think they made a heck of a concession. I think they made two big concessions that were not conceded, let's say, at the earlier levels. And I think for the most part, I think that they are conceding that the evidence as a whole strongly suggests it doesn't, and in my case, it's a lot stronger than that, but it says that he didn't do it. They come up with a theory to say, well, he didn't do it, but maybe he was involved. And in all candor, although I think the state's concession is somewhat gracious, that isn't that gracious, because I don't think that there's really any reason to believe that he was involved in this crime. And I think that's sort of a stretch on their part, and to a certain extent, I guess, if that's polite, and if that takes away the sting of a guy doing 7 years in prison for a crime that he did not do, well, then that's okay. But the bottom line is he didn't do it. And the evidence is overwhelming he didn't do it.
Well, is your strongest argument, do you think, forgetting about any concession they're making, is your strongest argument here that there was indeed prejudice under the Strickland approach because of the fact that the information concerning the statements made by the brother were never fully presented to the jury?
Oh, yeah. I am saying that if this trial would have been done right, if the trial attorney would have taken the steps that any reasonable, prudent attorney should have done, his client, I believe, in all probability, would have been acquitted in about 15 minutes. The evidence is overwhelming that what the guy was wearing, just on the green pants alone, that alone basically cuts in favor of the defendant. Then, of course, you have the fact that you have the black eye. The person that perpetrated the crime on that day did not have a black eye. My client, at the time of the crime, had a black eye. And then, of course, on top of all of that, you have the fact that the guy confessed to the crime without, I think even the state concedes 3, I think it's actually 4, I don't want to quibble on the 4th, but the bottom line is they even concede that he confessed to 3 other people. 2 of them, of course, were members of his own family. Now you can say, well, geez, his own family would lie, but is his own family going to lie to say, this brother did it and this brother didn't do it? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, of the brothers was already charged with murder, wasn't he? So what's one other crime?
No, actually, Your Honor, that's not accurate. He wasn't charged with murder until after this. When Daniel...
Wasn't he in jail?
No, he wasn't. And that is absolute. That is absolute. When Daniel confessed to the first 3 other people, to the 2 sisters and Mr. York, he was not in jail. He was out of custody. He talked to the trial attorney after he had been arrested. But the first three people that he said, I did the crime to, and he gave a very detailed story to two of them, that is when he was not in jail. He was not arrested on anything at all.
Counsel. Some of the details, Mr. Summers, were not quite accurate. Didn't match the victim's details.
Actually, it doesn't mean that they're accurate. Actually, it means that probably the victim's remembering of the events was probably slightly off. And that's what I said in my reply brief. I do trials all the time, and it's amazing now that the state sort of has done a flip-flop on this, because in the average trial, you go in there, and the victim's account always doesn't match up with a few other witnesses' testimony, doesn't match up often with, let's say, some facts that everybody knows to be true. And what does the state say? It's no big deal, folks. These things happen super fast. It happened. You can't expect them to get every single fact right, can you? That's absurd. No one could ever suggest that they have to get every single fact right. And that's exactly what has happened in this case. Basically, is the victims gave a version, which I'm sure they gave as honest as a version as they could have given. But their version actually was about events that were happening awfully fast. And all that we know is that when he said, I did it, he corrected it. He corrected it, and the way that he corrected it makes sense. These aren't major discrepancies. They are things that are extraordinarily minor. And of course, too, it goes back, let's say, for the sake of argument, that this was some kind of a plot to say that he confessed when he didn't confess and so on and so on. I think it's absurd, but let's just say that that was what was going on. Well, if that was what was going on, why wouldn't he just say it exactly the way the victims had said it?
Also, perhaps to you it's a slam dunk, and perhaps it will be to the court. But basically, we're looking at what the defense counsel did and whether he was ineffective. Now, as I read this thing, here we had Daniel, and Daniel made statements to Cole that conflicted with statements that he made to the police. In other words, we have conflicting statements, and they were conflicting with what the eyewitnesses were, okay? And then Daniel also took the Fifth Amendment. And so when we talk about a slam dunk, I don't know, it may or may not be. Now, I know that in recent events there have been some question about eyewitness statements and the concern there, and I'm not... maybe I'll ask the state about that, but certainly there was, if there was some trial strategy that defense counsel had, perhaps he had some idea of these concerns. Like here you have a witness that wanted to take the Fifth, and how do you handle that? So I'm just asking you, seem to think it's just automatic. Well, I don't know how automatic it would be if this goes back to a jury, because the jury still may come down with the same verdict even though he gets a new trial, which may or may not happen. But I'm talking about ineffective assistance of counsel and what counsel was faced with when Daniel gave different statements to different people. What's your take on...
Oh, well, okay. First of all, I would put forward that if he's given a new trial, I'll do the best I can to do that trial, and I can say I've won a heck of a lot of cases that were tougher to win than that. And so from what I've seen, number one is, that's of course out there. But I'm telling you from my past experience, I've been in courtrooms, I've done trials, this is an easy winnable trial. He gets a new trial, I'm going to win it, and I can't guarantee it, but I bet you any money I'll win it. Number one, that's number one. Number two, in regards to the state...
How do we take that? Let's see. Now
I think we can take judicial notice.
You want to take judicial notice?
You would.
I think what you're saying is you'll pass the Strickland prejudice test.
Yes. And what I'm saying more than that is this, though. It isn't like the guy had a strategy. Even the state actually is conceding he really didn't have a strategy. Even the state has conceded that basically his answers were nonsense. Even the Court of Appeals said that his answers were nonsense. He said things that made absolutely no sense under the law.
We may not disagree with that, but I'm just talking about what was in the record and what he was faced with.
But that was the record that is the record in this case. He couldn't come up with any justifiable reason for what he had done. The bottom line was he didn't lift a finger. Investigator York wasn't even subpoenaed to the trial. He said prior to the trial, he told the court he wanted this evidence in. So that was his strategy. His strategy was get it in. But he didn't even take the minimal steps to get it in. He didn't even have the guy on hand, the strongest witness for his whole case, and he doesn't even bother to have the guy subpoenaed. In fact, according to the record, and this is the undisputed record, he never even talked to these people. Once he got the statements, he didn't do anything at all. He never talked to Investigator York. And he gave the incredible claim, the reason why he didn't was because it was work product of the previous attorney, and because he had to respect that attorney's work product, therefore, he could not talk to the investigator. That's just nonsense. Everybody knows it's nonsense. And that says the whole thing. There was no strategy. And then again, to go all the way back to say, hey, well, maybe he was worried about there would be some kind of discrepancy between what the victims would have said and what Daniel said to these other people. That wasn't his strategy. He has said that wasn't his strategy. He wanted to get it on. That basically, those, all that reasoning wasn't, didn't come from him. That came from the courts and from the state trying to uphold what he did. They're the ones now that have gone back and said, well, this isn't what he thought, and we say what he says was nonsense, but we're going to try to think of a way. We're going to try to think of a way why somebody in his shoes would have done it his way. And what you're really saying is, we're trying to think of a way to defeat justice. We're trying to think of a way, basically, to make sure what doesn't take place in this case is what should take place in this case.
Let's say, counsel, that we agree that this was deficient performance on the part of this trial attorney. How was it prejudicial, other than the fact that he lost the case and you could win it?
Well, how prejudicial is because if the evidence would have been presented to a jury, that's why I'm saying, the reason why I'm so confident that I would win it is not because I'm saying I'm some fantastic attorney. I'm saying because any basically average attorney who wasn't lazy at all, who just did his job, could have won this case. Because the jury would have
heard some out-of-court statements made by the defendant's brother saying that he, the brother, actually did this home invasion, not the defendant, except that the brother took back those statements when he was interviewed by the police, didn't he?
The bottom line is the brother, at that point in time, you might basically told the police, I didn't do it. At that point in time, of course, the brother had a, when the brother confessed to doing it, basically, he wasn't charged. When he took back his statement is when he was charged with homicide. So that one all by itself explains his motive for why he said, okay, I did it, and why later on he said, no, I didn't do it. He was awaiting his own trial at that point, that later point for homicide.
Okay, but how much of that would the jury know? If this had gone appropriately in the way that you suggest that any competent trial attorney would have tried the case, the jury would have heard these out-of-court statements. They would have been deemed admissible by the trial court, which, as I understand it, the state now says these are admissible. So the jury would have heard the out-of-court statements. The jury also would have heard the brother asserting the Fifth Amendment, right?
I think it depends on how the trial courts do it. I've had trial courts do it both ways. Usually they have them assert the Fifth outside the presence of the jury. But
isn't it actually the other way around, that when a witness asserts the Fifth, that does get presented to the jury prior to the out-of-court statements coming in?
Yeah, well, as best I recall, the trial judges, I'm doing it outside the presence. But he would have taken the Fifth either outside or outside the presence or in front of the jury. Then they would have put these witnesses on. And then so these statements would have gotten in. So the state has already conceded that. And so what the jury would have heard is that he confessed to the crime to his sister. They would have heard that he confessed to the crime to Investigator York. These people would have testified. I believe that they would have heard basically his partial confession to his mother as well. But even if he didn't have that, you would have definitely had two confessions to his sister and to Investigator York. Then the jury would have been able to make sense, too, of why the victims were so positive that the defendant had done it. The fact is, these guys were brothers, and they did look a lot alike. The state has tried to downplay that and tried to quibble with what the court said. But the bottom line is this. The court saw both of the brothers. And from the court's statements, the court strongly inferred, and I don't see how anybody could say it was anything different than that, that these guys look alike. In fact, the court was saying, the jury can't even see these guys because they look so much alike, it's going to throw them a curveball. Well, of course, that's the best way to explain why the victims would have been so positive that they had ID'd the right guy, because these were guys that were brothers, and they looked a lot the same.
Was there a motion to suppress the identification in this case made?
Well, in this case, no, there wasn't a motion to suppress, and I thought long and hard about raising the entire issue of the court and not allowing the jury to see the brothers. But frankly, I thought that was not as strong as the issue that we had, and I didn't want everything to get diverted to that. I think we have a lot stronger issue, so that's why I focused on what I focused on. But the bottom line is, if there was a trial, though, that would have allowed the jury to see why these people would have been so positive. It would have made sense to them, yeah. This guy looks, look at him, these guys are brothers. That's why they thought they had the right guy. And in regards to the other evidence there, again, you got two things. One is the whole thing about the green pants. On the day of the crime, we know the perpetrator was wearing green pants. The brother, Daniel was wearing green pants. That, again, ties up to Daniel. It doesn't tie up to my client. And, of course, we also know the whole thing about the black eye. At the time of the crime, one thing that both victims were positive about was that the defendant did not have a black eye. There was testimony at trial. I think it was basically undisputed testimony, but wasn't disputed much if it was. And that was that my client at the time of this incident had a black eye. So again, if the jury sat there, and if the jury was reasonable and fair, and I think we should presume that any future jury, and that jury would have been reasonable and fair, they would have said, you know what? The brother did it. They just grabbed the brother, put him on trial. He's the guy that should be here.
Mr. Summers, Cedarburg police investigated this burglary, robbery. Was there any blood at the scene?
No, actually, my understanding is there was blood. This is a thing. This is out of the record, but the state is aware of this. I think when I talked to the state, they even made the suggestion that I tell the court about this. There was blood actually on the clothes. The blood, I don't know about the scene, there was blood. When the guy did it, the brother, he got blood. He tracked blood on his clothes. The family preserved the clothes. The problem was the attorney told them to wash them. And that killed all the DNA. That's why the whole thing. The attorney, the same guy, and again, it would have came down to a swearing match between him and the family. The family is all here right now. They did preserve the clothes, and there was blood on the clothes. The problem was the family, on the advice of the attorney, washed the clothes.
Yeah, but he asked you at the scene.
Yeah.
Was there blood at the scene?
That's from the scene, so I'm saying. I know that there was blood. The Pacific's blood, I don't believe.
How about on the glass on the gun case? Was there blood on the glass on the gun case? That's where the brother said he cut himself. If he did, it should have been blood on the gun case, too.
Well, I would agree, but also I would say this is the way the brother says that he broke the glass and the way that the victims say that he broke the glass is basically one and the same almost.
It is, but the brother said he cut his hand on the glass of the gun case. And the question from Justice Prosser was there blood at the scene? Not on his clothes, but at the scene.
I understand it. And
was there?
I'm not sure, but the point I want to make, and this is the main point, that doesn't really make any difference because the victims, basically, their account of how it was busted, it was that he did it with his hand.
But if there was blood at the scene, you could test the DNA and find out which brother.
And I don't believe that there was blood that was preserved at the scene of the crime. But the how he busted the glass, in his account, was he just punched it. How the victim said
it. Does the police report indicate there was any blood at the scene?
I don't believe there was any blood that was preserved.
Does the police report indicate they saw blood at the scene?
To be totally honest, I don't have that right in front of me, and this is a pretty big record, and I can't give you an answer. The state maybe might be able to answer that. I think from reading her note there, it says no blood at scene of crime.
Well, thank you, Steve.
Daniel, has the statute of limitations run as far as any prosecution of Daniel is concerned?
I believe it would have I'm not up to date on statutes of limitations of crime. I think that I would have thought that that would have ran out last year, but I'm not sure. To be honest, it's not an area of law that I don't really deal with.
If the statute of limitations has run, is there any reason why Daniel shouldn't be willing to make a statement now?
I think that he is. I think to a certain extent, but the bottom line is that Daniel, I mean, he was convicted of that homicide case. Unfortunately, as this court knows, in other cases where people come forward to clear somebody when they've been convicted and they're doing long sentences, they're not given much credibility. A lot of claims have been defeated on that basis. We got something a heck of a lot better than that, of course, is that he confessed to this crime prior to ever being charged on anything else and when he was a free man. But with Daniel, would he come forward right now to say that he did it? I believe that he would, but I got a hunch that the system would say that's not that big of a deal. And why focus on that when you can focus on the fact that when he had everything to lose, he said that he did it. And he
why,
said he did,
why you know. Why did Mr. Girard wait so long to bring this issue up?
Actually, I don't know if this court is aware of the history of this case. I only stepped into it very late. His original attorney said there was no merit. And that's why. And that's why the original appellate attorney appointed, I don't know how that could possibly be, said there was no merit. He was in the Wisconsin prison system. He went to the PD. I represented one of his cellmates. He asked them to appoint me. They sent me it. I said, I liked it, and I said, I'll take it. And that's how I got involved. But that was way, way after the fact. It wasn't his fault at all. He actually, from the very beginning, tried to push it. His original attorney said there was no merit and never filed a no merit report claiming that my client had authorized him to do so. He didn't have that in writing. And that's why the Court of Appeals actually allowed the deadlines to be reinstated. But that wasn't any fault of his at all. He actually wanted everything to be pushed, and there's a lot of documentation to that effect.
How many guns were stolen?
What's that?
How many guns were stolen?
Guns. Oh, that was a series of guns. There was a number of guns that were taken.
And they recovered how many?
I don't know. The whole point of the guns being taken, there was no guns that were connected ever with my client. That wasn't any basis for his conviction. The guns were taken by Daniel. Daniel was a member of a street gang. He had his purposes with the guns. I don't believe any of the guns have ever been recovered, but that wasn't none of the guns have been recovered. And there was never, ever any link between my client and any of the guns. That has never come up. I don't think it's ever even been alleged.
Okay. Is there any question of law here? If you're going to state the question of law, what is it?
What was that?
What is the question of law this court is to decide?
I think this question of law is to decide whether or not, I think the number one issue is whether is for this law to define the grounds of ineffective assistance of counsel and to how far courts should be allowed to go to infer, let's say, rationales to trial attorneys. The trial attorneys themselves have never said, that's what I was doing, that's what I was trying to do.
And what's the test in prejudice in Strickland that you're recommending?
Well, I'm basically, to a certain extent, I'm actually recommending that there be sort of a common sense approach to it. And that instead of basically sort of being this viewpoint of, well, let's see what we can do to sort of uphold what has happened, basically really to be very interested in justice. Because again, these stakes are very, very high. And in this case, the guy's been locked up for 7 years. And so that's what I'm really asking. I think this is essential for this court, really, to put the system as is right now on hold. And say, hey, you know what? We really got to take a look at it. We really got to take a look at the second prong. The second prong is a good prong, but it has to be interpreted as it actually is.
I understood the state's brief. The state's position is that your client had something to do with this crime, but was not the actual actor, but was a party to a crime, and under the statute, the party to a crime is as guilty as the actual perpetrator, but that it would have made a difference in sentencing.
Yes, and I see that my time is up. All I'll say is this. He wasn't convicted of that. No one has ever come up with that theory till right now. And I think that he should get a new trial to prove, not just be resentenced. He should get, if the state really believes that that's what actually happened and that's their theory, then they should be able to prove that at a new trial. Now I'm putting forth that if he receives a new trial, not only will he be acquitted of not being the perpetrator, I'll tell you, I'd bet almost anything he'll be acquitted on everything, everything. He won't be convicted as party to the crime. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Summers. Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Mueller, representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the Court. In light of the unusual posture of this case, I would like to present my presentation just by giving the state's basic position and then entertaining questions from the Court, because I think there are a lot of factual discrepancies, partly due to the record itself and partly due to the great lapse of time between the trial taking place in 1996 and the Mockner hearing not taking place until 6 years later in 2002. It's the state's position that if we proceed on the issue that was raised by Mr. Summers, ineffective assistance of counsel, that the Court of Appeals was correct in finding that Girard did not prove that his trial attorney, Mr. Kurzinski, was ineffective. However, having said this, the state believes that the record as a whole shows sufficient grounds from which this court, in the exercise of its discretion under 750-106, could decide to grant Mr. Girard a new trial in the interest of justice on the ground that the real controversy was not fully tried. And when I refer to the real controversy, that is, was he the person who entered the Borkelt residence in Cedarburg and committed the crimes in that residence?
Did they bring in alibi evidence?
No notice of alibi was filed, and at trial, Mr. Kurzinski conceded that since it hadn't been filed, he would be unable to get in portions of Daniel's statements to other people saying that Joseph was elsewhere at the time of the crime.
Is that ineffective assistance, that no notice of alibi was filed?
It hasn't been one of the allegations. Mr. Summers has never made the allegation that the failure to file a notice of alibi was somehow either deficient performance or prejudicial. One of the questions that arose had to do with whether this would be a slam dunk, let's say, if Mr. Girard were tried under a 930-905 theory. And I think Justice Wilcox hit the nail on the head. No, it would not, because if this got retried, obviously the state, before going to trial, would look carefully at this aiding and abetting theory. And I think the most cogent evidence in the record showing that Joseph was involved in the crime comes from the statement taken from his then-girlfriend, Kelly Weber, which is the supplemental appendix to the reply brief in this case. She was interviewed 6 days after the crimes occurred, and she gave a statement basically indicating that Joseph had plenty of advance knowledge that this crime was going to occur, that he vacillated back and forth about whether or not he was going to go along with Daniel when Daniel, quote, did his business at some small town in Wisconsin, and that eventually Daniel did come to her home where Joseph was sleeping on the morning of the crime at about 4:45, and he picked him up in a maroon car. And this car supposedly was a stolen vehicle. That's what Daniel told Kelly Weber. The two of them left, and in fact, you can infer from the statement that Daniel Girard gave to Investigator York that there was a neighbor who lived in the vicinity of the burglarized home who told police she spotted a maroon car at about 6:30 in the morning near that house. That would be very consistent with Daniel and Joseph being outside the residence. And in fact, Daniel, in his out-of-court statements, kept saying that he did the crime with another person. But he would not say who that person was. He said he would never snitch on the person. And when Investigator York said, well, then why did somebody report just seeing the driver sitting behind the wheel? He said, well, the other person was slouched down in the passenger side of the car. I think from all of the evidence that's in the record, and a lot of it that the jury, you know, did not hear, that if there were a retrial and you were trying Joseph on a party to a crime theory, there'd be plenty of evidence to show that he participated in this crime.
Counsel?
Let me, if I might, ask you about this. I understand you're taking the position that if we focus on ineffective assistance of counsel, that the Court of Appeals was correct. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, when I look at your brief, you're indicating in your brief that let's say there was a retrial, and let's say the charge was aiding and abetting, party to the crime. You seem to be conceding that the sentence might very well be much different if this was an aider and abetter rather than the perpetrator, the direct perpetrator of the crime, that the aider and abetter wouldn't likely get 50-some years in prison. Now, given that approach, how can you argue that there's no prejudice? It seems to me that that's an argument that just doesn't make sense to me.
I think superficially it doesn't, but when you realize that in the Court of Appeals, Gerard via Mr. Summers was never arguing that some of the evidence that I'm talking about now, the statement of Kelly Weber, that was never brought in. The Court of Appeals was not asked to look at that statement to see whether or not that corroborated anything. I brought this up on my own under this theory of possible discretionary reversal. I think the Court of Appeals looked at how strong the eyewitness identification of not one but two victims at the scene of the crime was and weighed that against various discrepancies in statements that Daniel allegedly made to people out of court and with actual evidence put in by the victims. And that brings in this whole idea about blood at the scene of the crime. There was no blood at the scene of the crime. Detective Backus testified to that. They looked for blood. Attorney Kurzynski said if there had been blood found at the scene of the crime, he could have had it tested to see whether it belonged to Daniel because the clothes that the sister, Judy Cole, turned over to Kurzynski had stains on them, which presumably looked like blood stains. These clothes were never tested. So my point is that if you're looking at ineffective assistance of counsel, the way it was presented to the Court of Appeals, and that was simply whether had these out-of-court statements come in, would there be a reasonable possibility the jury would have either had a not guilty verdict or a hung jury, I don't think that that was satisfied because I think that jurors would look at how these women independently picked Joseph out of both a photo array and a live lineup, how he had been to the house twice before. There was no indication Daniel had ever been there, and Daniel's statements were obviously not all true.
Well, let's say we take your approach, or what seems to be your approach, and we say, okay, we're going to avoid the whole idea of ineffective assistance of counsel, but we're going to grant a new trial here in the interest of justice, that the case or controversy was not fully tried. What are we going to use as justification? What's your justification for us taking that approach?
My justification would be that the real controversy here was, did Joseph enter the house and commit these acts? The real controversy wasn't presented as, was Joseph involved in these crimes in any way possible? It was he the person they identified? And looking at the record as a whole, not just limited to the statements that Daniel made to various people out of court, but looking at things like the Kelly Weber statement, I think for me, it just had a lot of weight to indicate that Joseph probably was involved in this crime, but there was a good chance he didn't go in the house because she described the clothing that both of the brothers were wearing on that morning when Daniel came to pick him up. And Daniel's clothes matched, or fairly much matched, the description. Joseph's did not. So I would be relying a lot on that particular piece of evidence, which no one else has really focused on, and also the fact that even though there were these very powerful eyewitness identifications from both Elizabeth Borkelt and her mother, neither one of them was ever asked to view a photo array or a lineup in which Daniel Girard appeared. So it was a combination, I think, of those two factors. I think, too, the fact that Daniel was later convicted of homicide shows that the violence in the household would have been consistent with his kind of behavior.
Does the record contain contemporary photographs of the two brothers? I mean, there's testimony.
Oh, a photograph as of today, you mean?
No, at the time.
Oh, at the time. The photo that was in the photo array that was shown to the women was taken, I think, 6 months before the actual offense. The offense occurred February 23rd, 1996, and I believe the photo of Joseph that was in the array was taken something like September of 95. I'm not exactly right, but I'm exactly sure of that date, but I think it was September of 95. The booking photo of Daniel that was shown to the jury, it was not shown to the eyewitnesses, but that was taken on February, I believe, the 28th, because when the search warrant was executed at the Girard household, Daniel fled from the house and was apprehended like two blocks away, and he was charged with possession of marijuana as a result, and then a booking photo was taken. So the photo you see in the record of Daniel was contemporary, definitely.
Your focus, then, is on whether or not the defendant before the Court of Appeals proved ineffective assistance of counsel, as I understand it. And your focus is that before the Court of Appeals, you had only the statements that were in issue and not some of the corroborating evidence, green pants, maybe blood on clothes, that kind of stuff. Your opposing counsel in the reply brief argues that you're inconsistent in saying that there was no proof or there was not the ineffective assistance of counsel, and yet in the interest of justice is your approach. Specifically on page 2, opposing counsel argues that there is an inconsistency in the state's contention that there's no reasonable probability that Joseph would have been acquitted if the jury heard Daniel's out-of-court statements, only to then express the writer's personal doubts that Joseph was the actual intruder to the Borkelt house. How do you respond to that?
I don't think it is inconsistent, because if this court were to grant a new trial under 75106, when you do it under the basis that the real controversy was not fully tried, there's no necessity of finding the probability of a different result on retrial. So it's not the same as under the miscarriage of justice standard. And miscarriage of justice standard is more akin to the prejudice finding under Strickland. And I don't think that if you look at the out-of-court statements Daniel made supposedly to his sister and to Investigator York, because I disagree about the statements to the mother or to Attorney Krasinski. I don't think the statements to Blanca Girard were against penal interest. He never admitted that he had committed the crime to his mother. And I don't think the statements to the attorney were so far against his penal interest when made, because he was assured that the attorney would do everything in his power not to implicate Daniel. So I think you're only talking about statements that were made to the sister and the investigator.
Can I say this? Because the real controversy was not tried, there is a reasonable probability that Joseph would have been acquitted if the jury had heard that controversy tried?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily the case, because I think that if the prosecutor had known that a lot of these statements were going to be coming in, the prosecutor is not a fool. He's going to switch course and say, okay, let's look at Kelly Weber's statement here and submit the theory that this brother was involved. Maybe he wasn't the person who walked into the house and committed the crimes inside. But at the very least, he's sitting outside and he knew his brother was going to commit that crime.
When I say acquitted, I mean acquitted of the crime charged. That's what I, when I say acquitted, I don't know what I mean. But it seems to me that you're making a nuance that is subsumed by the inquiry of, is there a reasonable probability that Joseph would have been acquitted of the crime charge? Because that's what we're dealing with, I think, on review, only the crime charge. And you seem to be saying that in the interest of justice, if the real controversy had been tried, there's a reasonable probability that he would have been acquitted of the crime charged. I mean, it seems to me that's what you're really saying, and yet for some reason you're pulling back from the reasonable probability, and yet it seems that one is subsumed by the other in your argument. No?
I don't think it's subsumed, because I think that when you say that the real controversy was not fully tried, you don't need to find that there's a probability that the result is going to be different.
No.
It's just that important evidence was either left out or was improperly brought in that could have influenced the jury's verdict.
My response sort of is that this is not an academic exercise. I mean, if it doesn't make any difference whether or not the real controversy is tried, then why would we send it back to do it? I mean, it has to make a difference.
Well, I think it makes a difference, because the theory under which the case was tried was that Joseph Girard was the only person involved and that he went into the house and committed all these crimes. And it's totally up to you as a collegial body, and you have a lot of discretion to exercise your power under 75106, and certainly you're not required to exercise it in this case. But I just believe that after looking at the record as a whole, that I had an ethical obligation to point out that he might very well have gotten a much more severe sentence than he should have merited had he been tried under the theory that he was simply, I guess you'd call it, the wheelman, or somebody who sat outside and did not enter that house, because the trial court made it clear that I'm holding you 100% culpable for this. You alone were the one who did all these actions and gave him a 52-year aggregate sentence.
How can we say at the same time that he was not mistakenly convicted of being the perpetrator in the home, and at the same time that he was the guy outside in the car? Those things are mutually exclusive, aren't they? I mean, if we say in the context of deciding the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that there was no prejudice here because he was not mistakenly convicted of being the guy inside the house.
Well, I think you have to look at what the basis for the claim of ineffective assistance was. And when I'm talking about the possible reversal in the interest of justice, the piece of evidence that I mentioned, I relied on a statement of Ms. Weber. Neither the prosecutor nor the defense attorney wanted that entire statement to go to the jury. And I'm assuming, although I can't get into their minds, I'm assuming the prosecutor didn't want it to go to the jury, because then the jury would know that this girlfriend was basically saying, my boyfriend didn't go in that house. He waited in the car while his brother committed this.
That's not what her statement says. Her statement only says that they left together in a maroon car. There are no eyewitnesses placing two people at the scene. And
no,
there's nobody who places him in the car.
Right. I understand. Her statement says that when it was done, she asked him what he had done, and that he admitted to her that he went along for the ride and sat in the car. So the prosecutor obviously didn't want that to go in, because it undercuts the eyewitness testimony. At the same time, Attorney Kurzinski didn't want it to go in because it undercuts his client's trial testimony, where he says he was dropped off at a Super America and paced around, or, you know, went inside and stayed at Northridge Shopping Center for over an hour. So that statement, I don't think you can really consider when you're evaluating the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, because Mr. Summers has never argued that Kelly Weber's statement should have been introduced, and it was obviously a strategic decision of the trial counsel not to get her whole statement in. All they wanted in was the idea that Joseph had a black eye at the time that the crime was committed. Daniel had given him a black eye, and yet neither one of the eyewitnesses noticed any damage or injury to his eye. So I don't think that when you evaluate the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, you can kind of change what the argument was presented to either the trial court or the Court of Appeals or to this court in the brief in chief. And that's why I think it might sound like I'm putting forth an inconsistent position in terms of saying there's no ineffective assistance of counsel, but yet this court could choose to exercise its power of discretionary reversal. I mean, I think there's precedent for that. This court did something similar in State versus Hicks, where it had to do with DNA evidence, and this court rejected the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, but nevertheless said the real controversy was not fully tried because this evidence was not presented to the jury. So I don't know if that satisfies, your belief that why it's inconsistent, because I really don't think that the two are based on the same pieces of evidence.
Do you have to charge aiding and abetting?
Do you have to? No.
No. So the charge here was perfectly all right.
The charge, yes.
Even if they proved aiding and abetting being the driver rather than the
I believe driver. That's correct.
But if that's a theory, the jury has to be instructed on aiding and abetting.
Right. That's correct. The jury then would have been instructed under 93905.
There was no such instruction.
No.
Okay.
Is there any physical evidence tying this defendant to the crime?
Not that I can think of. The guns, there were five guns stolen, never recovered. No blood was found at the scene. They picked up the glass fragments. No blood was on the glass. The clothes I can't speak to. Mr. Summers has the clothes, and they never were tested. And I can't vouch for, you know, his statement that the family was told by the trial attorney to wash the clothes. If that advice was given, obviously it's pretty bad advice. But I don't know whether that happened or did not happen. And one point I did want to address was the idea that, I think Justice Sykes brought this up, would Daniel Girard have taken the Fifth Amendment in front of the jury so they could have seen him do that? And I think under State versus Heft, it is not done in front of the jury, and that would not have been the case here, where the state knows in advance that a witness is going to invoke the Fifth. It's done outside the presence of the jury.
So. What's the, if you should prevail on one of your theories anyway, and it goes back to trial, the issue of corroboration might still come up. Should this court rule on corroboration?
I think it might be helpful to discuss corroboration in the sense that it appears to me that the Court of Appeals may have believed that the corroboration that's necessary to admit a statement against penal interest that exculpates the accused and inculpates the declarant has to be corroborated by independent physical evidence. And that's clearly not the case. This court in Anderson and the Court of Appeals in Johnson, I think, make it clear that obviously it's helpful if you can corroborate a statement by independent physical evidence. Sometimes a statement can be self-corroborating. So yeah. I think it's clear, I mean, I think it's important to point that out if this court decides the standard of corroboration, because in Anderson, this court did not adopt the stringent federal test for corroboration. And there are a lot of actually similarities between the statements that were at issue in Anderson, because there it was the defendant's brother, just like in this case it's the defendant's brother, and in there the out-of-court statements were made to the defendant's mother, and I believe it was a private investigator, and here you've got, or maybe it was the attorney, it was one or the other, but you've got a lot of similarities between the two. And in Anderson, this court held that the statements were sufficiently corroborated and should come in.
We have another question, and that deals with Strickland. I'm just not clear as to what the test is for prejudicial error under Strickland. Is it the same as, except for who has the burden? I recognize that. Defendant has the burden in a Strickland case.
Correct.
Is it the same test as the prejudicial slash harmless error test in other cases? Justice Bradley referred to it as a reasonable probability test. The briefs refer to it as a reasonable possibility test. Just what is the Strickland test?
I think the word possibility and probability have been used interchangeably under the harmless error test. And
what does the U.S. Supreme Court case say?
I believe Strickland uses reasonable probability of a different result.
And you think our cases go use both? Okay.
Well, I think in Dyess, I think the two terms were used interchangeably, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. So is it the same as the harmless error test?
I'm not 100% sure, because in Harvey, this court
rephrase my question. Is it the same as the Chapman test? Because
Strickland to me seems to be slightly less rigorous than saying beyond a reasonable doubt that the result would have been the same.
Well, it says that it affects the confidence in the outcome, the reliability of the verdict. It's not outcome determinative, if I understand the language, but it affects the outcome. And that's one of the Chapman's phrases, is that you don't have confidence in the outcome.
Right. I think that phrase comes up, too, in Lockhart versus Fretwell, that it undermines confidence in the outcome of the trial, and you want a trial whose result is reliable, if I'm kind of paraphrasing that.
And that's the Strickland test, you think. So that sounds like Chapman. And you think that you have to show more or less prejudice for Strickland than you do in Chapman. You said you thought it was less rigorous. I didn't quite understand what you meant.
I think that if you look at the state having to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that an error was harmless, to me that sounds slightly more rigorous than a defendant having to prove that there is a reasonable probability of a different result. I don't know if I'm right on that, but it just sounds that way, that beyond a reasonable doubt sounds somehow a little bit stronger or more strenuous. In closing, the state believes that the Court of Appeals was correct in finding that Gerard did not demonstrate that his trial attorney was ineffective under Strickland versus Washington. However, in light of the record as a whole, this court, in the exercise of its discretion under 75106, may decide to authorize a second trial in the interest of justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Assistant Attorney General Mueller. Mr. Summers, you have a few moments in rebuttal.
Yes, I have a couple points. The first point is that in regards to the test, I think that there is some confusion under the law. It goes back to Strickland. It seems like usually the state has been arguing that you have to show a reasonable probability of a different outcome. There's also language in there that has said that you have to have confidence in, that it should be overturned if there's no confidence in the outcome. And there has been a blur with that. I think in this case, though, this would be that both tests are met, either way you see it. And the last thing I'd put forth is, the states, again, their argument is somewhat gracious, but it's not gracious. And they're saying that, hey, do it by saying that the full controversy wasn't tried, so give him a new trial in the interest of justice. And I hope they're saying a new trial versus him being resentenced. But anyways, even with that, that's somewhat of a sleight of hand, and I know it's strong, but you know, what killed the first prong of the ineffective test was that in the beginning, everything was interpreted as people saying, you know what, we have to look at that test, and we have to say, what did the trial attorney do, and why he did it. And in time, basically, they came up with a new explanation. We don't have to say, who cares what he said? All we have to say is that some hypothetical, reasonable attorney someplace would have done it his way. And that has basically defeated almost all claims under the first test. Now we have a new radical proposition really being thrown out for the second test. Up until today, I have always thought anyways, that the second test was you judge it by what you went to trial on. What would be an outcome at a second trial if you were charged in the same fashion? It appears now that the state is saying, hey, he can't change his argument about ineffective assistance of counsel as he goes, and I think that's fair. But what they're saying now is that when you come to the second prong, now we have a new way of doing it. We can say that the outcome would not have been any different because we think that the district attorney would have been an intelligent person, and we think he would have looked at the evidence, and he would have charged them in a different fashion.
Counselor, do you agree with opposing counsel that if we send this back down, party to the crime does not have to be charged in order for him to be tried on it?
I think she's saying that that's, unless I misunderstood her, she's saying that's exactly what is going to happen.
Well, I'm asking you, do you agree? It doesn't, with her statement. Yeah, that is what she said.
I think if you try it back, I mean, it's up to the state to decide how they're going to charge him. But I believe what she's saying is that's why we fail for the ineffective assistance of counsel claim is that at a new trial, he would be or probably charged, in her opinion, as aiding and abetting. That's why she's saying that's what I interpreted her argument to say. That's why we failed at the second prong.
Okay, but that wasn't my question to you. My question to you was, if we send it back, do you agree with her statement that there need be no further charging in order to try him both as the perpetrator and as party to the crime?
Well, yeah,
that's the choice of the district attorney. It can go forward in that on that basis, given the documents that are currently filed.
I don't think that... But then the charge him is, I mean, this has never really come up, actually, until the state came up in their brief about this aiding and abetting theory. No one has ever moved forward on that. All, let's say, in the criminal complaint, he was alleged to have been the direct perpetrator. I mean, all the way through that. To go back and look to say, I mean, I think that he could probably have a challenge, if they challenge it, I mean, on the bindover. But that would be the, let's say, duty of the trial attorney at that time. But it would be up to the state to say, hey, you know what? We think he's still the perpetrator, or we buy into the new theory and that we can charge him as aiding and abetting. But that wasn't, no one has ever said that.
I'm not doing a good job of saying my question. My question is simply, given what is currently charged, forget everything else, can they try him? Can they have a trial, bring him in, put in the evidence that goes to aiding and abetting and convict him of that? That's my question.
Oh, well, if you're saying, do I think that's going to happen?
No, can they do it? I'm not.
Well, they can do it. I mean, yeah, I mean, I guess they can do all kinds of things. They can tack on 3-4 crimes. But before there's any assumption that they would do that, I mean, I would hope that the district attorney is a fair-minded man, and I would hope that he would take a step back and say, you know what? It's a good chance he's innocent. And I think that to a certain extent, this whole theory that he was the guy in the car that aided and abetted, it's sort of a wild theory that's just sort of thrown out there. And I don't know why, to be honest, it's really been given any real credibility. There's really no reason to think that it's so. And just because that makes it all polite, well, fine. If that's going to give him a new trial, fine. But that somehow to defeat our claims and somehow say, well, it's not going to make much of a difference because that's what the state will do the next time, I just sure hope the court doesn't go down that path. I see that my time is up. Unless there's any other questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Summers, and thank you, Ms. Moeller, for your arguments today about corroboration, eyewitness identification, and the interest of justice, as well as ineffective assistance of counsel. That concludes our argument 02-2404-CR, State v. Girard. The students may remain here. Justice Process will be out to see them shortly. The other members of the court will be at 417 North State Capitol for a Lord Day celebration. We are recessed until 1:30.
1:30. Mm-hmm.